Welcome to Behavior Grooves, the podcast that explores our human condition. I'm Kurt Nelson.
And I'm Tim Houlihan. We talked with researchers and other interesting people to unlock the mysteries of our behavior, and we do it with a behavioral science lens.
Okay, Tim, this is the second of two episodes where you and I are reflecting on the History of Behavioral Economics series that we just produced and launched with Andy Luttrell called They Thought We Were Ridiculous.
Nice delivery there. And this is the last that you're going to hear from us about They Thought We Were Ridiculous for quite a while because, well, you might be worn out and we pretty much are as well. But we ask you to indulge us just one more time as we need to share some really important learnings with you.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a really interesting grooving session because we're gonna share what we learned in hopes that you can take some of our observations and apply them to your own work as a leader or a contributor in your company or your community, or when you're asked to keep doing your regular job and at the same time take on an assignment that is not your regular job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's real life, right? You could apply this to your own life to make you think about, you know, big projects, big initiatives. Okay, Kurt, let's get started with what we learned from talking with nearly two dozen behavioral economists, including Nobel laureates, about this topic of what it's like to start a movement.
Right. And I think the big piece here is I didn't go into this thinking we knew there was a story in the history of behavioral economics. We knew there was background on this. Mm-hmm. And having read Misbehaving and having read
a little bit of Thinking Fast and Slow.
And some of, the other works that are out there, right? I knew there was a background in this, but really understanding this changed. These people that we talked to changed the foundation of a field that had been going on for hundreds of years, not just decades, hundreds of years. Now you can argue, well, the classical kind of economic model and the rational person is really took forward, you know, just in the past, you know, from the 30s and 40s onwards. So yeah, it may only decades. But in reality, this group of people, right, changed this field. It was a big endeavor and it wasn't without controversy. It wasn't ever always going to, this didn't have to happen. This could have floundered. This could have, you know, wilted on the branch. But I will quote Margaret Mead, "Never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed individuals can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has."
And they did. They changed the world. They changed the way they introduced into the common language. We talk about being biased. Biases have been around forever. But the idea of talking about biases, recognizing biases, seeing biases, understanding that we have these decision shortcuts that we call heuristics, wasn't part of the daily corporate work life, home life.
Government.
That was not a part of anything before these guys started introducing that language to us.
Right. And I think one of the key pieces, though, is going back to that Margaret Mead quote, a small group of thoughtful, committed individuals.
Yeah.
That these people came together. So think
not
about
one person. It wasn't one person. It was a group of people.
It wasn't one person with a great idea. It wasn't Danny Kahneman. You know, he had great ideas, but what if he didn't have Amos?
Yeah.
I mean, it would have been different.
What if they didn't meet Thaler? What if that hadn't have happened? What if Casbis didn't exist or Russell Sage?
Yeah.
Or Or what if Eric Wanner hadn't brought them together?
Yeah. You know, what if they didn't have the summer camps? What the world would be a different place right now. One of the big insights that I took from this is, look, if you have a big project, if you or a big idea, or maybe not even a big idea, but you have something that fascinates you, engage others. Get others on board with you. Find people who have that same committed passion about what you're doing. I love the Sendell quote where he's talking about, it's like if you were a stamp collector, but no, you didn't know any stamp collectors, and all of a sudden you went to this camp where it was all about stamp collecting, and like you just geeked out. It's like, first off, stamp collecting, Sendell, really? I mean, that's what you pick, but it's perfect for that, right? But it is this idea of find other stamp collectors. Because your ability to make an impact is going to be magnified. It is an accelerator for you when you are doing this as a small group of committed individuals, as opposed to an individual.
One other point along this idea of working with this small group is, if you can't find a small group, that might be a hint that maybe your idea doesn't really work with anybody beyond yourself. Just, you know, hashtag just saying. But because in the world today, you can find stamp collectors. You can find there is a wide and diverse way of communicating with the world. So go out and find those people. The second thing that I think is really cool about this is that they gathered like minds in this very free and open environment, right? This is like where really great bands thrive, especially when they are being formed, where everybody has a role to play, right? You can't have a band with nine guitarists. It's just,
why not?
It won't be interesting. It just won't. But if you have a drummer and a bass player and a keyboardist and a saxophone and a guitar and three people who are singing, like that's when it gets interesting, is by having all these different instruments in the band. This movement got interesting when you had psychologists and economists at the table in very free and open environment to hash out their ideas.
And I love that. It's a couple things there. The free, open environment that they're able to look at ideas, but they're bringing in a different perspective. It's
Elspeth Kirkman's work on
that we just talked to about. The perspective that you are bringing in is one that if you're all – Danny and Amos are psychologists, and they could have stayed in this psychology lane with all of this information. They would not have had the impact if they had done that, because, A, not only did they bring this in – published some of their first work in econometrics and, you know, challenged the status quo, but they brought on economists like Richard Thaler and George Lowenstein in order to be inside and be able to, you know, influence not just from the outside, but from the inside, but also because that brought a different perspective. And it made their ideas better.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And of course, that part of what makes that work is having a location, having a space. You and I have talked about this. There has been research to indicate that Zoom is really great for getting people together to come to a common decision about something. But it's not so great when it comes to trying to figure out, trying to brainstorm and open up new ideas. And so it's hard for me to endorse the idea that you could have this free and open environment for collaboration virtually.
Right.
That the space made a difference for these guys.
Well, let's just take Richard chased after Danny and Amos out to Stanford.
Yeah. Yeah, he pretty much did, yeah.
To be in that same location, to bump into them, to be able to work collaboratively with them, to have that. The summer camps brought people together in a way that wasn't, you know, part of their normal everyday job, which I think is really interesting. So there's a couple things about space. So it's not just being together, it's being together in a different location, often away from normal life, which allows that bonding togetherness, the interpersonal dynamics that are so important to any large movement, foundation, idea generation, the trust that comes with getting to know somebody at a more personal, intimate level, all of those factors that go into that. But there's also this away being providing a new perspective that you're not in your normal life, that you are in a different way. But I think that's really important. And one thing that didn't come out in the episodes as much, but they talked a lot, and this has been written about too, about walking, going on these walks and talking ideas. And there's something about movement outside in space, that in nature, that gives that ability to be more creative and to, you know, have ideas coalesce or form, that I think is really important as well.
In the years that I was doing projects with George Lowenstein, whenever we were together, it was never, never, never sitting down behind a desk in a conference room across the table from each other. We were always out walking. George just absolutely mandates that if we're going to talk about something important, we're going to be walking.
Yeah.
You know, and that it's a wonderful discipline to have that we have lost in corporate, global corporate worlds.
Yeah.
We've lost this idea that this movement can be really powerful and really rewarding.
Yeah. I think it's really interesting. So recap real quick of what we've just talked about, right? So lesson here, if you want to try to change something, if you want to do big, if you want to explore something in depth, just do it, but don't do it alone. If you can, get other people on board, bring in those others who are really fascinated about this as well. Not only will your understanding and knowledge increase significantly more than by doing it alone, but if you're trying to make a change and you're trying to impact something, that impact will be magnified, that you will accelerate however that is. And make sure that you are doing this so that it isn't just a correspondence, that actually, you know, they didn't have Zoom when they were starting to do this, so they had to get together in order to have that component. And I think we're missing that. I see this today in corporate organizations. It's like, oh, we'll forego that quarterly, you know, leadership team meeting, and we'll just do it by Zoom.
Yeah, don't do that.
I don't think that's positive. I think that you're missing out in all of the benefits that you get from bringing and gathering people together, taking them maybe off site, doing something different, and getting them out of their comfort zone and putting them together, because it creates a different dynamic, different brain functions, and you are going to have a better outcome.
The next set of things that I want to focus on is that big projects start with specific observations, not an overarching theory.
What? No, come on. You got to have the theory first. You got to go, here is the large scale, how everything works, and we're going to find all the individual pieces that fit into it.
Now, Danny points to this to some degree, but I think Thaler does it really, really well, that when he started the anomalies, before he even started writing anomalies, Before that became a thing, he just started making the observations one at a time on a blackboard in his office. So this, he didn't have an overarching theory. He was simply making the observations. And I think that if we're going to develop a new product, if we're going to promote a new idea, if we're going to write a book, start with just the observations. Just what is it that appeals to you about what you're seeing in the world?
Right.
I think that's a great place to start.
I think too many times within organizations too, we feel, particularly as a senior leader, you feel you have to come in with all the answers, that you have to have the entire vision mapped out. And this is something that I've done work with organizations on, where it's like setting the vision for a division or a team within an organization, and the leader goes, well, here it is. And I'm going, hang on, let's actually take a step back. Let's gather input from the group. What is the vision? Why is it important? What are those different aspects? And so it's taking this element of feeling like you need to have the solution set ready to go, and saying, no, we just need to observe. We need to make small, incremental kind of observations that let's look at what we can do in the short term that will lend itself to a larger picture. And I think that is really key. Now, it's not saying that you can't have an overarching vision and that's not there.
It's possible, yep.
But you know what? It's not a requirement. And so I think that's really important. Kind of with that, all of these people had the freedom to explore what interested them. It's one of the great things about our academic structure, that you get tenure and you can explore how tiddlywinks, how they work and various different pieces and their impact on the social, connections between whatever it would be, if that's what interests you. And I think too often in corporate world, in our own lives, we don't give ourselves that freedom. We don't say, what really interests me? Mm-hmm. And can I carve out some time to focus on that? I love 3M's model and Google's model, where they give their engineers, at least, I think they, at some point, I don't know if it was expanded beyond that, but, 15% of their time is to do whatever projects they want. I mean, you think about the innovations that have come from that, and it's amazing. I don't understand why more organizations, but we are so productivity focused. So like there's so much stuff we have to do. We can't spend time on not priority kind of elements, and everything's a firestorm. And we don't give ourselves that autonomy about where people, or give the autonomy to people or ourselves of where they spend their brain power. Give them that ability to, hey, what's the adrenaline rush for you? And, go for it.
In the same vein, if we're collaborating, we're going to be talking to other people. So if we're going to allow people to uncover their preferred ideas, it's really going to be best if those people that we're talking to allow our great ideas to bubble up, and that we allow their great ideas to bubble up, and that we can have sort of a meritocracy that says, these are the best ideas. And let our ego go and say, I thought I was interested in this, but now that you and I have talked about this, I'm actually seeing more value in spending more time on that part of the idea, or approaching my idea in this new direction. You can get this ping pong of effect that could build out better ideas over time through conversations, through collaboration, when you're focused on the meritocracy of the ideas, in large part by letting go of, at least relaxing your own ego on your own ideas.
And that's hard. It's a hard piece to do, but if you, and again, it's not the G.I. Joe fallacy, knowing isn't it, but knowing that it's going to be hard, like put structures in place. Talk about that fact up front. Understand that you're going to have confirmation bias about your own beliefs, that you are going to judge your, you know, something that you thought of as being inherently,
right,
you know, better than others. And so it's hard to have that meritocracy. But I think, again, in a collective, you know, you can get that. You can have, like, what does bubble up? You can, you know, what do people want to really focus on and take a vote and do different things? You can have those conversations outside of the normal structure. So maybe you take a walk and talk about things, and just the change in environment changes. All right. Well, yeah, that is interesting. Let's think about that. So yeah, I love that.
I worked at an agency where we had group brainstorm ideas. We used group brainstorms to create new ideas and to take client problems, existing internal problems, bring them to a group of people, have a formatted brainstorm to discuss ideas. And something that's worth remembering is that the first idea wasn't always the best. In fact, it was very rarely the best, right? The very first idea was just one of 50, 60, 100 ideas that if you just think, and James Heyman does a great job of explaining this, of if we look at the normal distribution of all the ideas, the likelihood of the first one being the best idea is about zero. So if you've got that nugget, I think here's the lesson, is if you've got this idea, start it. Just push off from the shore, start rowing, just start doing it. And let the best ideas bubble up. As you're pushing it forward, as you're sharing it with the world, continue to form it, continue to massage it, continue to sculpt it into something that's better, that maybe it's not just your ideas.
Take that leap. You know, you don't have to have the grand theory of everything. You can just notice anomalies, build off of those, work with others, take the best insights from everybody, and make that whole be much larger than the sum of its parts, right?
Absolutely.
I think that is a great kind of component. One other piece that I think we learned from the conversations and the stories that we heard is that change, particularly when it's changing paradigms or beliefs or systems, is super easy, super, super easy. And I don't know why anybody has any problem with it, right? No.
That's not what we heard.
No, it's not. It's hard. It takes a lot of work. Prospect theory didn't all of a sudden, like they produced that paper, didn't all of a sudden change the way that economists thought. And that the way they viewed the world, it had an impact on a small number, but you needed to have a lot of papers, a lot of projects, a lot of presenting at seminars, oftentimes contentious seminars where people would be yelling back at you and putting you down, and you are having to defend ideas, and it's not the warm fuzzy of, oh, that's a great new idea, let's explore this. It's no, you're an idiot for that idea. And understanding that you have to go through that if it is a big, difficult change, and don't get flustered and give up. You know, Annie Duke talks about quitting, but you have to quit. It's not, and you know, what I take from that, her stuff is, it's not about that we hang on too long, but sometimes we quit too soon as well. And so it's about knowing when to quit and when to hang on, and understand that change, a big change, is hard.
Along that quitting lines, it's also doesn't mean that you have to quit the whole thing, but there might be aspects of your idea or the thing that you're solving that you need to quit and keep moving forward with other aspects of it. Our friend Jeff Madoff is has been, for the last 4 or 5 years, been working on a play, a musical, that he finally raised enough money to, first of all, he wrote it. He went out and did all the work to find the cast and directors and the crew to mount it, brings it to Philadelphia, has a successful run, takes it to Chicago, has a successful run. He's continuing to advance the story to get it to Broadway,
yeah,
basically, one iteration after the other. And the play continues to be tweaked and rewritten, and little bits of the songs get changed, and the choreography gets changed, and the dialogue gets changed all along the way.
I love the story that he tells about this part in the play, in the musical that he does, that they had it, and I can't remember exactly what was going on, but he talked about it got laughs. It was, you know, the actors loved it, all of this piece. But then he went back with his producer and said, does this add to the story that we're trying to tell, even though it was good? And they said, no, it doesn't. And so they nixed it. And this idea of taking these ideas that you know have value, but maybe not in, if we're trying to change a system, if we're trying to get a big idea across, they don't lend themselves to moving that forward, mm-hmm. even though they're good, even though I love this, this is great stuff. Sometimes you have to kill those great ideas it's not saying no to the things that you just don't like or just that aren't good. It's saying no to things that are good because you have to focus in on what's great.
What really advances the story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to recap, like these guys, these men and women that made behavioral economics what it is, they wrote lots of papers. They went through lots of experiments. They had lots of studies. They had lots of collaborators. This involved a tremendous amount of work because changing a way of thinking and starting a movement takes a lot of work.
And they had a lot of failures.
Yeah, yes.
I mean, that's the other piece of this is that we remember is that, so if as a lesson, right, if you are trying to instill a significant change in an organization, in a community, in government, in any type of system or organization that has a strong culture, a strong belief system, a strong way of doing business, is that change is going to be slow, that it is going to require a significant effort. And if you really believe, and it's one of those things that you are going to, you know, this is important, you know, keep at it. Understand the pain that you're going to have to go through. Enlist others to help you. And change, as you talked about. It's not, you know what, there are certain things you might have to give up and other things that you might need to adapt. And just keep moving at it. I think that's the thing. So,
yeah, absolutely.
All right. So I think one other piece is this idea of they approached creating behavioral economics not from the outside, but from the inside. And it was very key and purposeful in the way that they approached this. And I think that is a great insight to how these types of changes actually get implemented.
Yeah, I think there's this great story that George told me about how he needed to be inside. He had finished his undergrad in economics, but he was thinking about going into psychology because he was really fascinated with this emerging field of integrating both psychology and economics. He thought, well, with his undergrad in economics, maybe he complements it with psychology. And he had a conversation with Amos Tversky, who said, no. He said, you need to get your PhD in economics in order to legitimize the work. And he said, you need to be on the inside.
Ah, to legitimize the work.
To legitimize the work. So we do need to think about, it's great to be the rebel on the outside. Like, it's very Hollywood-esque to come in and swoop in and change things. But if you're really going to be credible, if you're really going to know what's going on with the things that you're trying to change, whether it's how to change the user experience, you know, with on a mobile app, or change something at home. You've got to know how things go, how what the vernacular is. You got to know the territory.
Well, and you need to know people are influenced more by people they know and trust than by others, and particularly if they view those people as experts. And so by getting in, by having, you know, George become an economist as opposed to a psychologist, he was able to, it was the fact of Richard being in there and getting into the University of Chicago and being a peer to, you know, the leading economists in the country. This idea that you are part of the group and influencing that change, as opposed to a rabble rouser on the outside that you can dismiss, you know. And again, within an organization, within a community, within a government, unit, that change is going to come from the inside. You have to get in, and you have to influence the right people. And sometimes it's a bottom up where you get there, but oftentimes you have to do a both and, right? This is, you have to get that bottom up component, but you also have to convince the leadership. You have to be seen as credible within that leadership team so that they can support those initiatives and give it air cover, if nothing else, from maybe a larger part of the organization.
Which means you might be working alongside naysayers.
Yes.
Like Lincoln with the team of rivals thing. Like, you could be working right alongside people who don't necessarily agree with you.
Yeah.
At least at the start, or agree with everything that you're doing. And if you're going to vet the ideas and vet the concepts, you're going to be better off. They're going to be stronger if you actually work alongside the naysayers.
Yeah.
Right next to them. Work, you know, arm in arm with them.
One other piece. You know what? These guys were lucky. You know, I mean, in all reality, and I think this is a big issue. And we talk, Annie Duke talks about this, right? It's like, we look at decisions and it's like, oh, I made a decision, I did an action, and then I got an outcome. Well, no, when she talks about this, there's an element of luck in there. Like, she...
Everything,
yeah. You know, and she uses the card playing analogy, and oh, yeah, there's a, you know, I made the decision to take the hit, or to, you know, do the next card or stay in, and I knew the odds, but there's a luck of what that next card that comes up is, right? And even though the probability and the odds are in your favor, there's something there. Too often, leaders, in my viewpoint, and this is just me, look at, I made a decision, I got an action, and look at the great outcome that we have. And therefore,
I'm great.
I'm great. Everything I do turns to gold, and all of this kind of pieces. And you forget that there's an amount of luck. You know, you look at the barons of industry right now, and, you know, there's lots of people. This is the survivorship fallacy, right? This idea of, you know, oh, they got up at 5 a.m. and worked. Well, you know what? Thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of other people get up at 5 a.m. and work, and they are not, you know, in this place. There is an element of luck, being in the right place, having the right connections, having the right environment that is out there. You know what? If Richard Thaler would have came around 5 years earlier, it would have been different. If he would have been 5 years later, it would have been different.
Yep.
There's an element of luck.
The other part of the luck thing for me is being open to seeing the lucky circumstances that happen on you, right? Because Thaler recognized something in in Kahneman and Tversky, and wanted to be, and then he gets presented with this very fortuitous opportunity that they're going to be together. Tversky and Kahneman were going to be together in San Francisco or at Stanford and Caspas. And so Thaler said, okay, I want, so this is fortunate that they're going to be together. They're going to be in the States and I could get there. I'm going to be there the semester before. So I'm going to work to try to
extend
so that I can be with them. So he recognized the opportunity. And I know that this is silly, but it reminds me of this, like the story about the religious guy who's stuck on the desert island, you know, and he's praying every day, you know, God rescue me. And one day a speedboat passes by. And the guy comes up with a speedboat and says, hey, you know, I'm, you know, looks like you're stranded on this desert island. And the man says, no, God's going to save me. And then, you know, a helicopter arrives one day and the guy just waves it off and says, no, God's going to save me. And then like a cruise ship, you know, comes up and stops and the guy on the island just waves them off and says, no, God's going to save me.
Yeah.
And it's like, you got to recognize when these good things are happening to you as well. You have to be open to say there are happy accidents that are happening.
Yeah. And is that the end of that story where he dies and goes to heaven and goes, why didn't you help me? And God goes, but I did.
You know? I sent a speedboat and a helicopter and a cruise ship. Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, if we don't pay attention, this is what we've talked about too in some like finding your groove. It's how many times do we pass up that beautiful sunset because we're just not in the moment enough to realize what it is. And so I think there's an opportunity here that, yes, don't pass up the happy accidents, leverage them, but also take the luck.
Don't skip over it. Enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think that's it.
All right. I think there are so many lessons from this conversation, from what these people did. And I call them amazing people, but in reality, again, with that last piece that we just talked about, you know, there are lots of other really bright researchers who are studying stuff who maybe just didn't get the same kind of, you know, circumstances placed in front of them or the same types of different pieces, but they took advantage of those opportunities that were presented with them, and they did. They changed the world. And what I hope people will take away is that, you know, get a group of people, gather together, all of those factors, right? Collaborate. Make sure that you are, you know, giving yourself the freedom to pursue those ideas that interest you. You know, start with just anomalies, observations, pay attention, what's going on. Notice when things don't seem right and then build from it and then understand change is hard. Sometimes it's slow. You're going to have to go through a lot, man, you know, but, you know, fight from the inside and just don't pass up those happy accidents. And I think if we all take that, we can make change in our world, in our team, in our group, in our organization, in our community, in the nonprofit that we work for, in the government, the local community that we live in. And I think that's important. And I think, you know, these are amazing people, but they didn't start off as amazing people. They took the chances and the opportunities they had, and every one of our listeners can go out and do that as well.
And we hope that you take these great ideas this week after listening to all 5 episodes, and that you take our conversation today and we use it to help you go out and find your groove.